From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today for Earth Day, we begin by looking at colleges in Iowa at the forefront of the green revolution, energy-saving measures at Luther College, and an unplugged competition at UNI. Then a conversation with journalist Heather Rogers, author of the new book, Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. In it, Rogers questions the effectiveness of what she calls feel-good consumer solutions to the environmental crisis. She'll also explain what she calls the unsustainable economics of sustainable farming and the devastation brought on by the growing market for biofuels. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, on this Earth Day, a look at some areas of ecological thinking and action. Later in the hour, a conversation with journalist Heather Rogers. She's author of the new book, Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. That coming up in just a few minutes. But first, we could begin by looking at colleges in Iowa at the forefront of the green revolution. Joining me, first of all, Dan Bell-Richard, Sustainability Coordinator at Luther College in Decorah, joining us by phone from Decorah. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on the program. Now, you at Luther College are really, really serious about being green. Tell us, what are some of the specifics?
Well, we focus on many areas: energy, transportation, food, recycling, and waste. And one of the things that we've been getting a lot of notice about is our local foods commitment. We live in a great part of the state where there are a lot of local producers, and we've pledged to increase our local food purchase in our dining services to 35% of our overall budget. And right now we're up to 20% and making good strides on increasing that and meeting our goal. There are several other things that we're doing. One of them could be the vermicomposting that we do on campus, and that's in the residential halls where students can get rid of their fruit and vegetable waste via worms that eat that garbage and then turn it into very rich organic compost that we can then use on our student gardens. Those are two small examples of some of the things we're doing, but we're working on sustainable transportation initiatives and how can we get students to campus without them having to own a vehicle, to energy conservation. And we're looking at and trying to put up a wind turbine on campus that would generate about a third of our electricity use. And we're ever so close to doing that, but haven't quite gotten it done yet, but we're still working hard on that.
Dan, how did all this start and when?
It's really started by students. They really ultimately led to the creation of this program, and it really happened in three phases. Back in the 80s and 90s, there are a lot of individual and scattered efforts by students and then some faculty and staff. And there was a class that was offered called Applied Environmental Philosophy, where the students would research a project or a problem and then see how they could make it more sustainable. And the problem with this was it was really individual projects, and they often lacked continuity. So as students moved on, some of those projects would get dropped. But that was really the first part of that. The second phase really occurred during 2002 and 2008, when there was a conscious decision by the college to start and grow an environmental studies program. And through hiring the first time a faculty member, John Jensen, to work on this, he was able to coordinate faculty and staff and students to work on these issues, and then as well as add to the teaching and the number of classes and faculty teaching classes related to sustainability. And they were able to examine energy policy and local food purchasing, how to make biodiesel, which we do on campus through our fryer oil. And the third phase really started in 2008, and that's when sustainability became institutionalized on campus. Through our strategic plan, it became a major commitment. Also, when our president Torgerson signed on to the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, and that's a commitment to reduce our carbon footprint. And all of this, with now having the administrative support and then having the student base, it's really led to an increase in sustainability at Luther.
So, what does it mean to institutionalize sustainability?
It really means to have that in our strategic plan and make it a major focus on where we see ourselves in 5 years. And it's thinking very clearly and intentionally about getting sustainability into the curriculum, having more classes across many disciplines relate to sustainability and what they're teaching, but then also have the students and the faculty and staff actually take ownership and live it and be able to examine their daily lives and what can they change in what they do on a day-to-day basis to make it more sustainable.
Are the sustainability efforts paying off? Can you measure this in dollars and cents?
Although we don't have the best method for tracking actual dollar savings, there are some that we definitely know we're saving money, and just by generally reducing the resources that we consume, whether it be electricity or energy for heat, or the amount of waste that we put in the landfill, we are seeing reductions increase in our savings. When we did our energy audits in 2004, we identified $1.5 million in project improvements efficiencies that is now saving the college over $200,000 per year. We've also implemented a print limit system where we don't have dollar figures. We know that our paper order has decreased by 200,000 sheets of paper from the fall of 2009 to the fall of 2008. And like I said, by just keeping our compostable and recyclable materials out of the dumpster, we're able to save money on landfill costs. We went trayless in our cafeteria, and now we're able to run our dishwasher 2 hours less per day. And so that saves an estimated 700 gallons of water per day, not to mention the labor costs, the electricity going to heat that water, the detergent, the wear and tear. So there are definitely savings involved in a lot of these projects. Some of them we realize in the short term, but then also some projects you're not going to realize the savings until many, many years in the future.
Dan Bell, Richard, hang on the line, please. Joining us now, Austin Foster, a student at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Austin. Good afternoon.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on the program. I understand you were involved, one of the leaders in the week-long competition today coming to an end on Earth Day called UNI Unplugged. What is it?
Well, it's the culmination of a year-long service learning project coordinated by 9 presidential scholars from UNI. What we've done is, after like a semester that we had to decide what exactly our issue was going to be, we decided on sustainability, and then we went ahead with a 4-week program of curriculum that was on different things in the dormitories and the residence hall dining centers, and we coordinated with many different resources on campus to expose students for a number of weeks to the things that they could do on campus that would reduce their carbon footprint, and then we've culminated it this week with a week-long competition of our own.
Mm-hmm. So list some of the things that you recommend that all students at UNI do.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with the average dorm room nowadays, but it's just a maze of cords and power strips and different things. So we've encouraged students to unplug their televisions, their unused recharging devices, whatever those may be, and to set their refrigerators to a lower setting or even eliminate their refrigerators altogether if they can get by without them.
This is a competition. How will you measure who wins?
We've coordinated with the on-campus, the power plant, and they can actually measure the consumption down to the individual building on campus. So we have 9 on-campus residence halls that are participating, and we will actually know based upon our control week, percentage-wise, who reduced energy the most.
So do you get the feeling the students have been really into it the past few days?
They have been. Some residence halls more than others, but we've had a great response to our project, and we're very pleased.
What will the winner get?
The winner gets a number of things, but it's basically just like $1,600 distributed to that residence hall, 2 residents who committed to our pledge that they would participate. So it could be anything from a free dinner to a local restaurant to a gift card to a coffee shop.
That's a lot of pizza parties, $1,600.
Exactly.
Do you have any feeling, certainly a worthy competition to get people's mindset changed, but do you have any sense that past this competition that will have any long-term benefit?
Oh, we certainly hope so. We'd actually like it to maybe be a yearly thing on campus. We're not sure if that's possible yet. But we believe that especially young people, they want to do the right thing. So if you can explain to them why they should do it, how it will affect them, and their communities that they will keep doing it. And that's why we had the 4-year or the 4-week curriculum coming up to the week of competition, because we didn't feel that a week of reductions would necessarily be enough to really get it imprinted in their minds.
Back to Dan Bell, Richard. Austin is a student here, very excited about this, as students at UNI are excited. Dan, you've been at Luther College in Decorah for a while. How much of a change do you notice in the attitudes among students about green thinking, green action?
Oh, I notice a lot of change. I actually graduated from Luther in 2001, and coming back and seeing how the campus is now and how the students react to sustainability now is completely different. And part of it is, I think there's just a growing consciousness by society to think about sustainability more, as well as there's a lot more data out there and a lot more access to that data. So students, when they have that experience with an individual or out in nature, when they start to think about how can we preserve this for future generations, they have that data and that communication via the web, via the social marketing or social tools like Facebook, to really take that experience and then make it into action. And that's what students love as well, is to create action and to do something differently.
We had a competition between dorms at the University of Northern Iowa ending today. Dan, is there a competition among small liberal arts colleges, for instance, like Luther, to determine who is greenest? Do you keep tabs on other colleges in the Midwest?
There are certainly the systems that do track that. But we just got back from a conference in River Falls about sustainability for the Upper Midwest. And really, the campuses there want to see change and want to see more sustainable institutions. And we're there, we're sharing information, sharing projects, and really out there trying to help other schools to do exactly what we're doing. And that's what we're really about, is seeing the change and not competing against each other.
Okay. Do you think it could be used, though, as a recruiting tool, for instance?
Oh, definitely. I think students that are coming into school are looking at the institutions and what they are doing in relation to sustainability. And I think it does help you if you are more consciously aware of what you're doing on campus. And it will definitely help you out.
Okay, very good. We have to leave this for now. You've got actual worms in those dormitories eating the food leftovers.
We do. We have worms, and we're hoping to get them into the president's office at some point.
I hope you'll tell the president before you do that. Thank you very much, Dan Bell Richard, Sustainability Coordinator with Luther College in Decorah. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you a lot, Ben.
Austin Foster, thank you for joining us from Cedar Falls, a student at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you, Austin. Involved with the week-long competition called UNI Unplugged. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with journalist Heather Rogers, author of the new book, Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. In it, Rogers questions the effectiveness of what she calls feel-good consumer solutions to the environmental crisis: organic food, reusable shopping bags, carbon offsets. We'll find out what that's about when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, Earth Day, we're examining aspects of the green movement, sustainability, energy consumption, the economy, and how these and other areas interact. My next guest is author and journalist Heather Rogers. Her new book, Green Gone Wrong, leads readers into forests, fields, and factories around the globe to draw out the unintended consequences and inherent obstacles that lie beneath the surface of environmentally friendly products. Heather Rogers, in this book, you set out to evaluate the effectiveness of the green movement, specifically what you call feel-good consumer solutions to the environmental crisis. Let's start by having you summarize the feel-good actions you investigated.
Well, a lot of them are consumer-based, and the key to the actions that people are taking these days to address climate change and environmental crisis are these products that you know, are most readily available. That's what you and I can do. And organic food, hybrid cars, carbon offsetting, biofuels, those are the types of things that we have the greatest access to. And they've gained a lot of popularity. The number of farmers markets in the U.S. has gone up by 300% in the last 15 years. So people want this stuff. Now, the question is, you know, is it environmentally sustainable? Is it economically sustainable? And what are the social impacts? And those are the types of things that I get into in the book.
Okay, let's first look at some of the parts of your book that have a lot to do with Iowa and the Midwest. Of course, Iowa, one of the country's leading agricultural states. Mm-hmm. The huge growth in the market for organic food that we've all noticed in the last few years. And you visited organic farmers in upstate New York. What did you find?
Well, the thing that's most striking that I found is that these farmers, some of them, one of the farmers I visited sells greens for $40 a pound. He sells eggs for $14 a dozen. And you'd think at those
prices... Did you say $14 a dozen?
I did. It's shocking. You'd think at those prices, first off, it creates a very significant barrier for regular people. I mean, we just can't afford to buy that food. But that's the type, you know, he uses the type of processes that are really... environmentally sound. The reason, you know, the reasons that all of the produce is so expensive are really connected to this fact, which I was very surprised to find, which is that this farmer and the others that I visited and many more are having a really hard time making ends meet. They could never afford to buy the produce that they grow and sell.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the problem are, you know, is a structural lack of support for these farmers. The USDA pours hundreds of billions of dollars every time we have a farm bill into conventional, ecologically unsustainable agriculture, and they really ignore these small farmers. So one of the farmers, the one that sells his eggs for $14 a dozen, he's losing his farm because he's having to pay exorbitant property taxes because he's 65 miles north of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and he's been in business for 30 years, and he's widely respected in culinary and farming circles, and, you know, he just can't survive.
So wait a minute. I buy organic eggs, cage-free eggs from, I would hope, happy chickens or happier chickens,
mm-hmm.
and they're $3 or $4 a dozen. How do you get to the difference between my eggs and the eggs that you saw made?
Well, I don't know exactly, you know, all the ins and outs of it, but basically, you know, the eggs that you buy are certified organic eggs that there are a lot of surprising things in the national organic standards that we use. For example, those chickens that you know, the cheaper eggs are from chickens that don't necessarily eat, you know, they're not necessarily free range. And when they are, it doesn't mean that they actually go out into the range. They can have access to it. So that means there can be a door on the hen house. Whether they actually go out or not is an entirely different matter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much cheaper to raise chickens in that way in confinement. And they can still eat organic feed and then therefore be called organic and free range, even if they're not out pecking for worms in the grass.
So in 2002, the USDA fully implemented some organic standards in order to clear up, I assume, what is organic, what qualifies as organic. How effective have these standards been in helping us figure out what's on our grocery store shelves?
You know, I think there are some qualities about having standards that can be useful, but what got into the standards and what got left out of the standards is incredibly political. And also very deeply tied to economic interests. And ultimately, that's what I found in these different areas that I looked at, you know, is that the economic interests really drive the options that we have. So therefore, the profit motive ends up taking the lead in many cases. But the National Organic Standards are, you know, they're kind of alarming. They don't forbid deforestation, for example. That is okay under the current law, under the current standards. The standards also don't require testing for pesticide and chemical fertilizer traces on produce and in soil. And I think that's surprising for a lot of people. I assumed that, of course, it got tested, and no, it's not required.
So while you say you're organic, that's what organic means, none of these pesticides, no one's verifying that.
Correct.
Mm. So why is organic food, the organic food that we see in chain stores, your Walmart or Whole Foods, grown overseas?
Because the United States has only 7% of the world's organic cropland. And as organic has gone big with companies like General Mills and Kraft buying up these smaller organic companies like Cascadian Farm and Muir Glen, which are owned by General Mills, they have to have, because of the scale they operate on and because they, you know, they're running 24/7, there's no seasonal in the world of General Mills. They have to go wherever they can to get the organic inputs that they need. And so increasingly they're going to developing countries, they're going to China, they're going to South America, and it's, you know, it's so that they can make organic agriculture fit their business model.
And you witnessed some amazing things in your, well, this was six countries you visited over 3 years to research this book. In Paraguay, you found some amazing things. Tell us about that.
Well, I went to a sugar plantation that is one of the top organic sugar plantations in the world. And this plantation provides a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the U.S. So I thought it was pretty emblematic of how organic agriculture is carried out in these places that provide to the U.S. and Europe, which are the top organic consumers. And what I found was that this plantation was, in fact, deforesting in order to expand its organic cropland. And that's just not what we think of when we imagine what organic, you know, we're spreading organic around the world, you know. And consumers, when they buy it, you know, they think that they're doing the right thing. But all of this is very complicated. It's embedded in politics and economics and, you know, all these different social forces. So it's never just cut and dried. And it's really important for us to look at what is happening on the ground. They're also monocropping on this plantation, and that depletes the soil, and it reduces biodiversity, you know, and it takes a toll on water systems. So, you know, they're not spraying chemicals at this plantation from what I learned, but they are doing these other practices that are troubling, extremely troubling.
Mm. So it raises the question, given the choice between buying organic produce from overseas or buying some locally grown conventional produce, say from your farmer's market, which is environmentally better?
Well, it depends on how the local producer is growing. I mean, some conventional local producers are incredibly principled in how they farm, and many do not get certified organic because of their principles. They think that the national organic rules are too lenient and too, you know, inadequate. And so, you know, somewhere between 2,000 and 3,500 farms in New York State that farm organically have not registered as organic because they just don't believe in the standards, and for other reasons as well. But so it's hard to know, because then also local conventional farmers can just douse their fields with chemicals. So it's hard to know.
You have to ask and trust your farmer.
You do. You have to talk to them. And also, you know, one of the things that just comes up again and again with the subject matter is that we are so often asking ourselves, what can I do as an individual consumer? How can I make the best choice? And those are important questions to ask, but we also need to ask the larger questions about, you know, what are the choices and decisions that are being made politically? What are the choices and decisions being made in the process of production? You know, that what are the choices that General Mills is making? Why do they get to make those choices? So it's not just up to you and me. What we do matters, but there's these bigger structural forces that lead us to this place where we have the options we have are the options that generate the most profit. And it's really hard for the market to adequately value the environment. That's why we're in the mess that we're in.
Coming up after the break, more of my conversation with Heather Rogers, author of Green Gone Wrong. If you've just joined us, my guest is Heather Rogers on this Earth Day, journalist and author. She is author of Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, which traces the history and politics of household garbage in the U.S. Her latest book took her 3 years of research, and she went to six countries outside of the United States, Borneo, Paraguay, Germany, the U.K., and India among them. And the book is called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Let's talk a little bit more about another agricultural-related aspect you talk about in the book. A few years ago, well, let's talk about biofuels. A few years ago, people were saying in Iowa that with all our cropland, our agricultural expertise, and with the coming of biofuels, that Iowa would become the Saudi Arabia of biofuels. What have you discovered in terms of the pros and cons of this growing market for biofuels?
Well, it's very controversial. I went to investigate what was happening on Indonesian Borneo, which is increasingly growing crops for biodiesel production. And so that's that. There's two kinds of biofuels. There's ethanol, which your listeners will be very familiar with, which is replaces gasoline. It's made from crops like corn and sugarcane. And then there's biodiesel, which replaces diesel, and it's made from oil crops, soybeans, canola oil, palm oil. And these, you know, emit fewer greenhouse gases than fossil fuels. But, you know, that's just what comes out the tailpipe. But what goes into getting all of that into the tank of your car is can be incredibly environmentally devastating. And what I found on Borneo, I went in pretty deep into the rainforest there, and I found that communities are being dispossessed, indigenous people are being illegally kicked off their land, their forest is being cleared without their consent, and it's being replaced by these vast plantations of oil palm trees. And the rainforest on Borneo is one of the last large remaining rainforests on the planet, and so it has an incredible amount of value for us in terms of its ability to store and absorb carbon. And as the Indonesian government has allowed, I mean, there's a lot of corruption involved. There's a lot of transnational corporations that are benefiting from this. But as the deforestation has gone on in Indonesia, it's made that country the world's third largest CO2 emitter after the United States and China. Mm-hmm. And this is not a country that has developed industries.
Now, Iowa has had ethanol plants spring up all over the state. And, of course, a lot of Iowa farmers, in fact, farmers no doubt listening right now, have crops, are planting crops this spring to be used for biofuels. Is that as bad a situation in the United States when you grow a crop for a biofuel?
Well, this is a very contentious issue in the United States. The organizations like Growing Energy and the Renewable Fuels Association are fighting the inclusion of these knock-on effects into the carbon footprint of ethanol. They're fighting that very hard because once you factor all of that in, ethanol can emit double the CO2, and some estimates are higher, double the CO2 of fossil fuels. So, you know, it's hard to figure out where do you start the calculations. And from what I can tell, it's really worthwhile to have a more systemic approach to how we do this, because if we just continue calculating emissions along this very narrow margin, we're going to continue destroying the environment in ways that we can't afford to do.
Now, the Obama administration strengthened fuel economy standards to something around 35 miles per gallon. That's to be by the year 2016. How was that arrived at? You said it's not necessarily the best solution that we arrive at, but one that is dictated or heavily influenced by industry and politics.
Yes. The major automakers, including Toyota, who is known for their environmental friendliness, they fight higher fuel efficiency standards every step of the way. And the reason they do that is because larger vehicles are far more profitable, and they also happen to get really low gas mileage. So an SUV, you make thousands of dollars in profits, and a small fuel-efficient car, you make hundreds of dollars in profits. So the math, you know, just clearly leans toward big cars with more features. And all of that weighs more and gets lower gas mileage. And to convince these companies to implement technology that already exists is very, very difficult because it will eat into the bottom line. And, you know, you look at Ford, for example, they have a model called the Fiesta, which some people remember from decades ago, which they currently sell in the UK, a very sleek, updated version. It's a five-seater car. and it gets 88 miles to the gallon.
And this is not a hybrid?
Nope.
Hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, they don't sell it here because there are a lot of features that Americans have come to expect, like air conditioning and automatic transmissions and, you know, large seats and things like this that weigh more, that, you know, bring down the fuel efficiency, but also have much higher profit margins. So their profit margins on vehicles in the U.S. is higher than they are in the U.K. and Europe. But, you know, if what we're waiting for is the automakers to figure out how to make the technology that already exists more profitable instead of just implementing it, which they could be doing, you know, then we're making a very risky bet.
Heather Rogers, I'm looking at the cover of your book right now, Green Gone Wrong. It has a picture of wind turbines, turned on their heads. In fact, it could be a picture from central or northwest Iowa. Iowa, I'm sure you're aware, is second in the country in terms of wind power generation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very positive view of wind farms, wind energy, the future of it, and how ecologically friendly it is. Now, you're not going to disturb that view, are you?
No. The reason that the windmills are turned on their head on the cover is that we have the technology. It's really the point that I was just making. We have the technology. We have the know-how. We know what's wrong, and we know what to do about it. Now, that technology can and will be improved, but we know what we need to do, and what's the holdup? And the holdup is that we're waiting for manufacturers and industries to figure out how to make it more profitable, and that, you know, is just it's incredibly dangerous.
Now let's talk about some of the other what you call feel good solutions to the environmental problems that we've all been trying to do as much as we can. Let's go to light bulbs, energy efficient light bulbs, the compact fluorescent light bulbs. I've seen studies, we've heard studies, summing up all of the energy that can be saved if we would just change all the light bulbs in our house.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be a good thing.
Yeah, it is. You know, when you and I do things like that, it definitely reduces the energy that we use. You know, houses in the U.S. emit 40% of greenhouse gases. Buildings in the U.S. emit 40% of greenhouse gases. So, you know, it's no mystery that if we use less electricity in our homes, it will definitely help things. But again, you know, most electricity, most energy is used in manufacturing and, doing things like refining oil. And agriculture, you know, agriculture uses 70% of the world's water supply. So we're talking about CO2 emissions, but we also, you know, we also need to talk about, you know, global warming is the disaster that's sort of gripped the imagination of the American people right now. But there are other environmental disasters going on, and of course one of them is water. So the, you know, the decisions that consumers make, and the book is written from the perspective of the individual consumer, the decisions that we make are important, and but we need to understand, we need to put it in perspective, because you and I switching out our light bulbs is not going to solve the problem.
Now, I understand your intention here with this book, and also in explaining the downside of carbon offsetting. But aren't you worried that many of the points you make in your book could easily be used by those who are against the environmental movement, those who make fun of the environmental movement, say a Rush Limbaugh or a Glenn Beck?
Yeah, Ben. That's, that is something that...
Has that happened?
No, it hasn't happened. The book just came out yesterday, so we'll see.
If you're invited on, you will go? On?
I mean, we'll see. I would have to, you know, cross that bridge when I come to it. But this, you know, something that's important is that we need to be able to talk about this stuff in different ways. You know, it can't just be, you know, those guys grab onto it, so therefore we're going to avoid it. Because these are the kinds of things that people who care about the environment, who dedicate, you know, time and resources and energy and, you know, have emotional investment in doing the right thing, you know, they need to think critically about this stuff too. And that's something in our society that we're very timid about doing, and we need to do if we want to have a mature politics and if we want to generate public will, which will then, you know, push the political will, then we need to be able to have these kinds of conversations. And if, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck pick up on it, you know, I can't control that, but I'm going to continue having these conversations with as many people, you know, who want to participate.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Heather Rogers on this Earth Day, journalist and author. Her latest book took her 3 years of research, and the book is called Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Looked at some of the environmental solutions that have been put in place in this latest wave of environmentalism in the green movement. Now, which reminds me, you and I have been alive enough or long enough to have noticed over the decades, we've seemed to waver between ecologically aware periods and periods where we don't care as much. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's very true. There was a peak. You know, today is the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, so there was this realization in 1970 that there is such a thing as an environmental movement, and had never recognized itself as such before that point. So you had this real upsurge in interest in environmental impacts of mass consumption, mass production society. And in the 1970s, which was fueled also by the energy crisis, the oil crisis. And then in the 1980s, you know, late 70s going into the 80s, there was, you know, things kind of dropped down. You had a recession. You had a shift in government. And so, you know, the kind of priorities of the country shift in some way. And this is normal. Of course this happens. Then in the late 1980s, there was again an upsurge, and that was triggered in part by the closing of about somewhere between 70 and 90% of the landfills in the United States because of environmental protections that were finally implemented. So, you know, you had that garbage barge floating up and down the East Coast with the incinerator ash on it, and they couldn't find a place to dump it. You know, this was something, a story that everyone heard about. And that created another wave of environmental consciousness in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And that, you know, the tension around garbage, and that was when curbside recycling programs became very popular, and municipalities really had to come up with solutions about where to put their garbage and how to produce less. And so, you know, once that got under control, you know, then other issues came to the fore. And, you know, in 2006, in 2005, we had Katrina. In 2006, we had the Stern Review, which was produced in the UK for the government, which was the first attempt to assign economic value to global warming. And in 2006, we also had An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's documentary. So there was this confluence of forces that brought it all to the fore. And you know, so you see this happening, and now it's waning. You know, we have the recession, and people's, you know, attention has gone to jobs.
Aren't you worried about the latest polls that show that people don't necessarily believe in global climate change, global warming, and don't believe that it is something that we humans have created?
Still, I'm not as worried as other people. Still, the majority of Americans believe that global warming is real, and they believe that it's the outcome of human activity. And, you know, it's not so simple. You can't sustain that level of engagement with an issue as everyone's life conditions change. I just think that these fluctuations are normal, and I'm not, you know, I wish everyone were, you know, accepting of it and pushing for change at the level that seems to be necessary. But I also think that it's just, I don't think that it indicates that nobody cares anymore. I really don't. I think that the fact that that we have an environmental movement at all is a testament to how much people do care. You know, we're told that we need market-based solutions to environmental crisis because people only act out of self-interest. And what the existence of the environmental movement shows us is that people act also out of interests for things larger than themselves. They also act in collaboration and cooperation with each other. So in many ways, I think, you know, what's happening is very positive, and I think that it's important for us to, you know, to remind ourselves of that.
But at the same time, in your book, Heather, don't you say that green capitalism is actually undermining the ecological progress?
Right, yeah. I think that the market-based solutions are very troubling. They give us biofuels. They give us, unsustainable, quote-unquote, organic farming. And they give us carbon offsets, which are inadequate for reducing CO2 emissions.
Yeah, so is that a matter of tweaking green capitalism, or is capitalism itself inconsistent with environmental protection?
Capitalism is inconsistent with environmental protection. It can't adequately value nature because it has to grow. And in order to grow, the logic of capitalism is that it needs to use resources. It needs to transform natural resources into products. And you can try to shift that into swapping out green products for dirty ones, but you're not dealing with that underlying logic. And so you might make some small improvements, but you're not fundamentally going to restructure the forces that, you know, have led us to where we are and will continue to lead us in a direction that is perilous.
So you see no hope for, through regulation, say, or incentives, to get capitalism to help save the planet?
I think that regulations and controls definitely play a role. In my book, I talk a lot about a transformation of the USDA so that it supports truly sustainable farming. And there are a number of steps. Being aware of the fact that our options don't exist just within the realm of capitalism. There's a whole lot of other possibilities out there. And within capitalism, a lot of people are promoting, you know, we just need to be more energy efficient, and that will, you know, that will solve a lot of the problems, and that'll ultimately reduce costs, and consumers will like it, and, you know, it'll be more affordable for them, and then that will drive a shift in the market. But the thing is, when you do that, you know, the energy that's saved in a capitalist system, that energy isn't retired. That energy is then invested back into the industry, the business, in order for that business to grow. So when Walmart, you know, switches to a more fuel-efficient truck fleet and, you know, puts energy-efficient light bulbs in its stores, that energy savings doesn't get put away somewhere. It gets channeled right back into building another Walmart and another Walmart and another Walmart.
Mm-hmm. So what's the real solution as we wind up this conversation? The real solution, I mean, capitalism is the only game in town, right?
I don't think so. I mean, if we allow ourselves to explore, you know, how can we do this, you know, and it's a process. We all have to get engaged and see what, you know, what works, what makes the most sense. And I think that it has to be okay for us to say, you know, this isn't really working. And what are our other options? Because we have options, and so often we feel like we don't. And I think that that's an outcome of a very inadequate political system.
So how can we distinguish between practices that will curb or reverse damage to our planet and the charlatans that you describe in this book, the false hopes?
Mm-hmm.
As individuals, how do we know when everything is painted out there as part of the green movement, or nearly everything?
Right. Well, you know, one of the ways to practice, it's very hard to know. One of the ways that we can practice environmentalism is by understanding ourselves not just as consumers, right? so we can get involved in community groups. We can spend time on the internet researching things that we're interested in. You know, a lot of people think that if you want to be an environmentalist or you want to do something environmentally friendly, you have to go buy something that's green, or you have to, you know, go take your recycling to the recycling center. And there are other options that, you know, and those things are good. And we don't always know whether they're actually happening or not. And a lot of people question whether they're happening or not. But what you can, you know, the decisions that you can control in a way are okay, maybe you practice your environmentalism by educating yourself, you know, finding out what's happening out there. And you know, do you want to get involved? Do you want to participate? And, you know, what makes sense for you to sort of, you know, put your life in a context where you are part of a process of change? Because whatever changes we make are changes we're going to have to figure out along the way, and it is a process. It's not a product.
Heather Rogers, I want to thank you very much for this conversation. Green Gone Wrong is Heather Rogers' latest book, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Heather, thank you very much, and happy Earth Day.
Ben, thank you. Happy Earth Day to you, too.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us anytime. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org.